It is an honor to introduce Dr. David Pelkovitz this evening to deliver tonight's lecture. Dr. Pelkovitz holds the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Chair in Psychology and Jewish Education at the Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration at Yeshiva University, serving for more than two decades as Director of Psychology at North Shore University Hospital, NYU School of Medicine, and Clinical Professor of Psychology at NYU School of Medicine. Dr. Pelkovitz has consulted extensively with the Jewish community in the United States, Europe, and Israel on a wide range of issues facing children and adolescents. Dr. Pelkovitz has lectured throughout the world, published numerous books and articles, and has helped countless adults and children through different difficulties that have faced them throughout their lives. I speak really, though, on behalf of all of David's close friends when I say that having Dr. Pelkovitz here with us tonight is a particular honor. I personally and on behalf of all of David's friends want to thank you, Dr. Pelkovitz, for the support you showed all of us immediately following David's passing our first night back in YU 5 years ago. That night, Dr. Pelkovitz stayed up with all of us till well past 2 in the morning, comforting us and discussing ways in which we should cope with the loss of such a cherished friend. Rav Soloveitchik writes in Kodo Didofik that when dealing with tragedy, one must not ask why. Why did this happen? Why did this have to occur? But rather ask what? What can I do now? What can I do in memory of the person who's passed while dealing with this tragedy? As a means of coping and grappling with such a loss, we've always tried to take on different projects to memorialize David and properly honor his life. This annual shiur is obviously one example of something that we've done. I'm happy now to introduce an additional initiative that is inspired by the Rav's directive, the David Rodenstrich Scholarship Fund to Yeshiva Shalavim. The scholarship fund, a needs-based fund, will aim to assist a few students each year with a portion of their tuition. Shalavim was a place very close to David's heart. During his time learning there, he grew a mature perspective on things. He nurtured a tremendous love and excitement for Torah, and he gained an even more positive outlook on Eretz and Medinas Yisrael, all the while goofing around with his wide, infectious smile that elevated all of our spirits. This year, one student already has been the beneficiary of this scholarship, and our hope is for the fund to allow more students to experience what helped shape David into the Baal Midot and Ben Torah that he was. This initiative is really one way that we, David's friends, are collectively coping. 5 years later, we still miss David terribly and think about him all the time. I often wonder what he would be up to now, what career path he may have chosen, how awkward he probably would have been while dating. You know, but what I am certain of is that he would be really happy knowing that we're trying to provide more young men the opportunity to learn Torah in Israel on a high level and thrive in a positive environment. The scholarship fund is indeed an answer to what we can do now for David's neshama and keep his memory strong in his minds and the hearts of the collective community. Please take a few moments to read the flyer left on your chair for more information about the scholarship fund. If you have any further questions, please see myself, Aryeh Schlosselberg, or Eitan Mishkov immediately following this year. Again, I'd like to thank Dr. Pelkovitz for delivering tonight's lecture.
Hi, thank you for the honor of addressing all of you. I didn't know David, but I'll just tell you that for the last couple of weeks on the YU campus, a number of his friends just spontaneously approached me just to give me a sense of how much David meant to them. I'm going to try to weave some of that into some of the thoughts I'm going to be sharing with you in the next period of time. I'm going to start with 45 minutes, I was told. Okay? In case you're wondering. Okay, so what do you figure? You start throwing things at me at about, 10 or so? Okay. So, let me start with what I find very meaningful insight of Rabbi Ruchem Lubavitz on a very cryptic pasuk in Mishpatim. The pasuk there is describing God's footstool. And it says that it was kemase livnas hasapir. God's footstool was a footstool that was sapphire. But embedded in the sapphire footstool was a brick. And Rashi says, Zecher l'shibud Mitzrayim, to remind God, whatever that means, of our suffering in Egypt. So Rabbi Rucham Lubavitz asks a brilliant question. He always asks brilliant psychological questions. He says, Ma inyan shibud la'achar ha-ge'ula? What's the connection between memory of suffering after redemption? When you have redemption and you're living in the light, you're living in the sapphire, why would you need the brick? Why do we need to be here tonight? Why not just move on? And Rabbi Rucham said that the deep lesson that's taught us by the imagery of God's footstool is very often in life we go through tragedies, we go through loss, we go through suffering, unimaginable kinds of stress. But then life goes on, life gets better. And you may move on and you may be faced with a life pretty much dominated by light. And he says the lesson of God's footstool is to teach us that even when things are light, we have to infuse our life with the lesson of the brick amidst the light. The lessons of what we've went through, the lessons of what we learned from people who are no longer here. Kamase livna sasapir. Very often I'm asked questions, let's say at a high lifeline retreat. Child, let's say, had cancer at age 2. They have no memory of it at all. Now they're cancer free. Should we tell them? Child is born 10 years after a younger sibling was lost to some kind of an illness. Should we tell them? Why do that? And I, maybe more leaning on this beautiful Rav Yerucham, often feel that of course they have to know. It's part of their narrative. It's part of their life. And it's part of their gift. It's part of their gift to be able to learn from the brick in life, to be able to learn from the suffering and from the loss. You know, a number of years ago, I had a colleague sitting in my office, well-known expert in trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder. And we were working on an article, but having nothing to do with the article that we were working on, he showed me an fMRI of a patient of his. He was taking a series of a picture of this man's brain. This man was stuck in the World Trade Center in one of the towers on 9/11 and barely got away with his life. And he had post-traumatic stress disorder. And to better understand what was going on and how to help him, but also to better understand the nature of post-traumatic stress disorder, he managed to figure out how to take a picture of this man's brain as he was having a flashback to the worst moment of his life. And he showed it to me. So the man, this patient of my friend, is literally reliving that horrible moment when he was convinced that his life was over. And I looked at it, and it was striking. So you know what your brain looks like when you're going through the worst moment of your life? Broca's area is shut down. Your language centers are shut down. You're literally rendered speechless. But here's where it gets interesting. What he showed me in subsequent scans, that as he lit up the language centers, as he gave him words for his pain, that's where the refuah came. Naming the monster, talking about it, connection, some of the things I'll be talking about in the next 40 minutes or so, are the key to healing. In a way, again, it's what we're doing tonight. It's lighting up Broca's area. The Barbanel asks a great question. Why is it that Vayidom Aaron, right? Zachary Mos next Shabbos, right? Is it? I think. Shabbos HaGadol? Yeah. Okay. I could live without making that kind of basic mistake. But when Aaron hears the tragic news of the sudden loss of his two of his sons, it says the word Vayidum. So the Barbanel asked an obvious question. Why have the word Demimus? Why Demama? Usually the Hebrew word for quiet is Sheket. Why didn't it say Vayishkot Aaron? So the Barbanel answers, because sometimes when something really tragic happens, what happens is demama. Demama is where you don't even have the answer. Sheket is for when you have the answer and you choose not to articulate it. Demimus is for when you're literally rendered silent. Rabbi Chalap, the grandfather of the Rabbi Chalap at YU, had a Haggadah, May Morom. This is in my wife's family, Rabbi Chalap. It's all cousins in the family. And he's also very psychological in his thinking. So Rabbi Chalap, I think this must have been in the early 1900s in Yerushalayim, writes the following. He says that avdus, slavery, takes away our koach hadibur. It takes away our power of speech. When you're a slave, you don't have the luxury of expressing your emotions. You don't have the luxury of naming the monster. You just go on. Actually, a historian told me recently when he heard me talking about this point, he said that actually in American history, when anybody was writing in American history about slaves, they wrote about them as if there was no inner life, as if there was no suffering. They were literally viewed in history as beyond emotions. Okay, and it's only recently that there's a whole new field in American history of the narratives of the slaves in centuries ago. So just think about this. Just think about this as we get ready for the Seder. What Rabbi Chalap says is when we sit around the Seder table and we have Magid, that's our answer to the loss of Koach HaDibur. So when we're sitting around the table, okay, Monday night, okay, when we're sitting around the table Monday night, okay, and with our children, we are sharing our history. And sharing our history in terms of all kinds of suffering and all kinds of loss. But what we're doing as a people and we're doing as a community is our answer to the loss of Koach HaDibur. That's what Magid is. That's what it's all about. That's what the power of the Seder is and the wisdom of the Seder. The answer sometimes to difficulty in life is Magid. It's Magid. How many of you heard the story of the five coping rooms in Israel and then Elie Wiesel and the Russian prisoners of war? No? Okay. It's just a story that I tell sometimes too often. Sometimes a lot of hands go up and then I skip it. Okay. So I'm going to go now. I'm going to talk about three components of dealing with loss. Okay? And hopefully there'll be some practical take-home messages. I already spoke about one, but that doesn't count as part of the three. The first of the three is I'm going to talk about coping. Three times in Shas, there's a machlokas between Rav Ami and Rav Asi about how to deal with difficult times. About how to deal with worry, actually. So it's talking about the pasuk of Mishle of Dago Belev Ish Yashchena. If you have a worry in your heart, either push it down. So Chad Amar Yashchena Midato. One man Amar says, if you have a worry in your heart, push it down. Distract yourself. B'chad Amar Yasichena La'acherim. And the other view of saying it is you talk it out. Okay, so it's either the Samach of Hesach Hadas with Simba Samach Mistalfin, either distract, typical man response, or Yasichena La'acherim, which is often the more I'm not going to try to get myself in trouble here. The response, 80% of the time it's women, according to the research. I'll just rely on the research. If anybody wants to see it, I'll show it to you. 20% of the time it's men. Interestingly, those three times in Shas that this machlokas is mentioned, it doesn't say that one way is right. It doesn't say, being reminded of that evening 5 years ago, when we were talking, this is one of the points that I tried to make. Some of you are going to deal with this by needing to talk nonstop. Some of you are going to have to deal with it by throwing yourselves into other activities, but dealing with it in your own way. So here's the story that I'm going to use to bring this home. Speak to your right hemispheres a little bit. In 2002... I found myself being invited to Israel a few times. My main research area and clinical area is trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder. And the Israelis were much more knowledgeable about post-traumatic stress disorder than I were, the specialists in the field, but they couldn't think clearly for themselves. You could be the biggest expert in the world. When it comes to you, you have a hard time. Something I truly understand. Ein chavush matar atzmo mibeis asurim. The Gemara brilliantly tells us you can't free yourself from your own prison. So I was sitting in the Jerusalem Trauma Center speaking to a group of about 40 therapists who were dealing pretty much nonstop. Back then in 2002, it was during the Second Intifada, there were constant bombings, one after another after another. And I'm doing whatever I'm doing in terms of talking to them. They were all in a state of they were all traumatized themselves. They had gone through terrible loss themselves, but also they were in the thick of letting families know when there was news of a tragedy. It was an unspeakably high level of stress. And as I'm speaking, the phone rings, and it was news that there was a bombing in the Frank Sinatra cafeteria in Haaretz Ofim Hebrew University campus, and 9 people were lost. Immediately, the phone starts ringing off the hook. People are coming from all over the country. They're asking for help from the Jerusalem Trauma Center, and immediately my audience totally clears out. And there's only 3 people left. Me, the director, and the assistant director. And we're sitting down, and we're just talking. It's like, you know, how do you wrap your mind around that kind of a tragedy? And as we're talking, the phone rings again. And it was news that there was a summer camp in the middle of the country where one of the counselors, unfortunately, was lost in that pigua. And there were no therapists left. So Dr. Brahm, the director of the Jerusalem Trauma Center, said, David, could you go there? He said, could you spend the day there, tell the kids what happened, and just spend the day there. Luckily, he must have seen the look of panic on my face, and he offered to send the assistant director, who I've since become quite friendly with. She's become a world-renowned trauma expert, Dr. Ruth Paderensic. So we go together, we get into the camp, and no Israeli camp director is going to allow any American to tell him what to do. Immediately puts me and Ruthie into the corner, okay? Has us sit on a chair, and he gets up, which is as it should have been, and he tells the kids the horrific news that a beloved counselor, unfortunately, had just been lost. But here's where I learned an incredible lesson, echoing Ravami and Ravasi. He said there are 5 coping rooms. You guys deal with the 5 coping rooms. One room is a room where you could write letters to the parents of your madricha. The other room is the music room. Express yourselves musically. There were all kinds of musical instruments set up. They didn't have iPads or iPods yet, so they had Sony Walkman. Remember those? Another room was an art room. Another room was the talking room. And then the 5th room was the tefillah room. The kids were told they could go from room to room throughout the day. Not a single kid switched. They divided themselves exactly equally between 4 of the 5 rooms. Anybody want to guess what room was not chosen? Tefillah. Almost everybody says speaking, but Tefillah. It was too soon for tefillah. They were in a state of psychological aninos or whatever. It was just too soon. But a quarter of the kids spoke. We had an amazing day with them talking about other losses they had and just talking out their feelings. And our kids did art, and the writers wrote, and the music kids did music. I was very impacted in my understanding. And since then, there's been a lot of psychological research showing that one size doesn't fit all in dealing with the tough times in life. Sometimes one member of a couple will say, talk, you got to talk it out. Another member will insist, no, you got to learn, or I got to do stuck, or whatever. The answer is, like a nice old Jewish man, they're both right. It's whatever works for you. Whatever works for you. The following week, I go home. And if I remember correctly, it was right around the time of 9/11. The first commemoration of 9/11. I was asked to speak at a commemoration service. And I told over this story of the five coping rooms. Because I thought it had tremendous wisdom for people who were still reeling from the aftermath of the World Trade Center attacks. And afterwards, a woman came over and she told me the following story. And with this, I'll finish the C of coping. I'm going to do three C's. Coping, creating meaning, and connection. She said that the week before, Elie Wiesel was giving a lecture in Manhattan. Her father, who was a Vishnisa Chassid, was a bunkmate of Elie Wiesel in the concentration camps. As a matter of fact, that famous picture of Elie Wiesel peeking out through the barracks, her father was the guy right next to him, one of the guys right next to him. And just before she left to go hear Professor Wiesel speak, her father said, oh, you're going to go hear my old buddy speak. He said, I don't even think he'll remember me, but just go and say regards. Maybe he'll remember me. So she waits online after his talk. And she says, my father's not sure if you'll remember him, but he's still alive, and he just wants to say, give you his warmest regards. Immediately, Professor Wiesel's eyes tear up, she told me. And he said, your father never told you the story of what he did for me? He never told you that the only reason I'm here is because of him? And he went on to tell her a story that she had never heard. He said there was a day that was beyond endurance, even by concentration camp standards. They were being starved. We all know the stories. They were being exposed to unspeakable atrocities. They were in a state of total despair. And a group of Russian prisoners of war got a hold of some rat poison. They decided this is it. They waited online. Each swallowed it. To bring an end. And a line formed of all these Russian prisoners of war. Adolescence is a time where that kind of behavior is extremely catchy. And Elie Wiesel told her, every adolescent in that section of the camp decided, you know something? They're gonna put an end to us anyway. And they all went to the end of the line. He said, I fully intended to make that my last minutes on earth. He said, everybody went to the end of the line except for your father. Your father, the Chassid, retained his emuna even there. You know what he did? He went to the side of the line and he broke into the ancient Vishnitsa Nigen. For ani mamin be'emuna shlema b'vias ha-mashiach. He said, you know something? That song broke us out of our suicidal spell. One by one, we left the line. One by one, we surrounded your father and joined him in singing the ani mamin. Not a single one of us stayed on that line. He said, go home and tell your father. Sheli, shelo. What's mine is his. I would not have been here if it wasn't for that niggun. Sometimes it's music. Sometimes it's writing. Sometimes it's art. Sometimes it's connection through talking. Sometimes it's learning. Sometimes it's setting up a scholarship fund for a wonderful yeshiva, like the beautiful new answer in terms of meaning that we just heard about. But whatever it is, we have to understand Chad Amar Yashkan Amidata v'Chad Amar Yasichan Al Acherim. Second C is the C of creating meaning. You know, Rav Soloveitchik spoke about there are two basic ways of dealing with loss in life, or with dealing with the ongoing inevitable stress of life. Yiyud or Goral, right? So Goral, as you see what's happening to you, as you're being a log floating on the river at the mercy of the current. Yiyud is, I'm a man or a woman of destiny. There's a reason why this is happening to me. Now that may seem like a trivial difference, it isn't. Last year, in an amazing article written in a leading psychology journal, Dr. Salovey, the new president of Yale, wrote a series of three studies looking at how our attitudes towards ongoing stress, suffering, or loss impacts on our recovery. One of my favorite studies that he quotes, although he did three that all showed the same thing, he showed post-traumatic growth. But one of them is, as he talked about, a study of a group of hundreds of maids who work in hotels. And they were randomly divided into two groups. One group just did their regular maid thing, cleaning hotel rooms. The others did the same thing, but they were told the following: we're doing a very important wellness program. You're going to be our subjects in better understanding wellness in the workplace. So here's what we'd like you to do. When you're making a bed, we want you to do it aerobically. So you're shaking the sheet out. Do it 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, okay? As you're vacuuming, you're building up your biceps, okay? And literally had them imbue with some kind of health-related meaning everything they did in their job as a maid. You can imagine the outcome. Within 6 months, the maids who were in the wellness category in that group relative to the comparison group, they were less depressed, they were generally happier people, and they were healthier. Okay? Meaning, B'makom shemachshavto shel adam is the Baal Shem Tov would say, Shem hu nimsa ha'ish. You want to know where the person is? Look at what they're doing. And he calls this post-traumatic growth. There's been a lot of research on it. And basically, he describes Yiyud versus Goral. Many of you know who the new president of Yale is. Who's Dr. Salovey? He's a Soloveitchik. Okay? I doubt that he knows the work of his cousins on Yiyud versus Goral, but somehow, with whatever ancestral alchemy there is, he comes up in psychology with the... He's a psychologist, by the way. With the exact same formula for dealing with stress in life as his cousin, the Rav, did. Fascinating. They both come up with the same thing. It's all how you look at it. Or, to quote the magnificent Medrash Tehillim, the magnificent Medrash Tehillim says the following. It says, Ilu nafalti lo kamti. If I never fell down, I never would have gotten up. Ilu yashafti bachoshech lo hayaarli. If I never sat in the darkness, I never would have experienced the life. The light. And that's the essence of this sea of creating meaning. As we do that, again, you just witnessed it here a few minutes before I got up to speak. That's the key. That's the essence of how to go from Yiyud, from Goral to Yiyud. Okay? Still make sense? Okay. So that's the second sea, creating meaning. The third sea is the sea of connection. Okay? Some of you have probably heard me quote this study. It's my favorite study on connection. I have two things that I relate to on connection. And we all know connection, that's what tonight is. Tonight we're all connecting. In response to a loss, in response to loss in general, in response to getting ready for Pesach, but in response of trying to make sense through the connection. Here's two studies. One is the bottom of the hill study. Listen to this study. They put them at the bottom of a hill. And they say, estimate the steepness of this hill. If you're alone, you see the hill is very steep. If you have somebody at your side, the hill looks less steep. The closer you are to the person at your side, the less steep the hill looks, and the less tired you get walking up the hill. You just talked about Shalvim. David Oliver Shalom went to Shalvim. Shalvim guys always tell me, what is it? Is it on Yom Yerushalayim that the guys hike to go? Was it Yom Yerushalayim that you guys do that? They hike from Emek Ayalon, I guess, or Nof, whatever the name of the neighborhood is, to the Kotel. That's not an easy hike. It's hilly. It's right? Yerushalayim Harim Savivlo. Everybody tells me the same thing. The only way you're going to survive that hike is you have to go with somebody else. You have to have somebody at your side, you know. And that's the key. That's the key to that study. You know, one cannot recover from the losses of life without connection, without that kind of a connection. Second study was something put out in positive psychology literature that said, you know, if you want to understand resilience in the face of life's stress, and you only have one question to ask. Here's the question you ask. If you have one person in your life who you could wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning if you really need to talk to them. Okay, my poor wife, the day I read that study, 3 o'clock in the morning, I said, Lonnie, get up. And she jumps out of bed. What is it? I said, can we talk about something? She said, yeah, what is it? I said, go back to sleep. That's fine. So she denies that ever happened. Luckily, she was in a stage of sleep. She didn't remember. I'm telling you, it happened. Okay. So that's the other part of connection. But I want to make two more points on connection before I move on. One is the concept of turning toward. Because again, we're talking about learning lessons for our daily life in terms of bouncing off of this event. So I want to share with you both a psychological thought and a Jewish thought. There's a guy, John Mordechai Gottman. We brought him to YU a couple of years ago. He spoke to 330 rabbis and smicha students there. We closed out almost within the first hour of the program being open, or certainly the first day of the program being open. He's like one of the leading marital therapy researchers in the world, has over 400 peer-reviewed articles. He's brilliant. Happens to wear a big yarmulke on his head. That's just an aside. He's from University of Washington in Seattle. One of the things he told us that stuck with me in a way that actually changed my behavior. He has a concept called turning towards. And he showed a video. It's a video of a couple who were spending a week in an apartment near his lab at the University of Washington campus. And they have cameras throughout the public areas of the apartment, and the couple is sitting down for breakfast, and the wife gets up. And she's looking out through a beautiful picture window onto the campus, and there's a beautiful lake there. And she turns to her husband, who's reading the New York Times, and says, aren't we lucky to be able to be here? We're so lucky to be able to be here to spend a week working on our marriage. And he goes back to his coffee, and he says, uh-huh, and he just keeps reading, okay? It's an excuse for me to get a sip of water, okay? So here's what Dr. Gottman pointed out. He said that seemingly innocuous interchange is actually very significant. He says distressed marriages, often when there's a bid made for attention by either of the partners, you have a nekudas habachira, point of choice. You can either choose to say to yourself, you know something? There's nothing more important in my life now than to look up from my paper and talk to my wife. She's right. That's certainly more important than this article. I can get back to the article later. That's not important. What's important is now. What's important is to be able to nourish our relationship. He says, it's very easy once you notice this to fix it. It's true. I know that the 330 people who were at that thing told me afterwards it was the easiest thing to fix. It's very easy to fix. Once you become aware of that, you fix it, okay? With the turning towards, or as Viktor Frankl said, between stimulus and response, there's this space. In that space lies our choice. In that space lies our growth. We just make those choices in terms of how we use time in our lives and how we nourish the connections. So I heard something from Rabbi Krohn. Somebody tell me that Rabbi Krohn said that I think has real applicability here. Where's the first time in the Torah that it says that it has the concept of turning towards? It's Cain. Cain, just prior to the first murder in history. It says God rejects his mincha, and what's the words there? V'yel Cain, v'yel mincha so lo shah. God, what does shah mean? Didn't turn towards Cain's sacrifice. So Rabbi Krohn has a brilliant insight. He says, you want to know something? He says, when it says in the Gemara, Yesh Adam Kone Olamo B'Shah Achas, there's somebody who could merit the world to come in 1 hour, in 1 minute, in 1 moment. He says, no, that's not what it means. You know what it means? Shah means with one turning towards. He says, you're in shul, you see somebody who needs to be invited for lunch. You know somebody in the neighborhood needs a Seder to go to next week. You need somebody to invite to for Yontif meal. You see a friend going through a tough time and you say, how you're doing? How are you doing? He says, that's the Shah Achas. The countless times during the day that we decide whether or not to turn towards or turn away, that's the key, in essence, to what our life is all about. Another very important lesson in terms of connection. And now I'll just end this with this part. I'm not going to end the whole thing yet. You promised me till 10 after. Just one last point on the connection. Heard this from one of my brothers-in-law, from Rafi Butler. Here's what Rafi said. He said that, picture my Seder, let's say. Like, picture a Seder Monday night. And I know many of you will have a Starim like this. So imagine if at my Seder, I have sitting around the table, okay? Let's say at one end, my 92-year-old father, okay? And at the other end, my 4-year-old grandson, the youngest grandchild who's going to know what's going on, okay? He said, just think of what the collective memory is of such a Seder table. My father will be talking from first-hand experience, stuff he heard from my grandfather, stuff he heard from my grandfather who learned with the Chafetz Chaim and who was in Europe and went to Slabodka and who directly heard from some of the giants going back to the early 1800s, okay? Okay, so he was first-hand account of what he heard directly from a close student of the Chafetz Chaim. So that's one end of the table. But then, God willing, one day, my 4-year-old grandson, he'll be sitting at such a table, and God willing, he'll be the old man at that table. And he says, just think of what the collective memory of such a table is. It's about 250 to 300 years. Then he told me, you line up 10 such tables in one hall, table after table after table, and you have a collective memory going back to Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's how close we are to the story of our salvation. That's how close that connection is. Work it out. I know it's a little confusing. You'll have to work it out. I'll talk to you later, okay? I don't quite get it myself, but it's my brother-in-law. He's a smart guy, okay? Work it out. It's, you know, we'll make it work. We'll make it work, okay? Okay. Let me come to a conclusion. You know, The final ingredient I want to talk about is the ingredient as you move on in the process of changing. You know, the word nechama, as Rav Schwab and Rav Hirsch said, doesn't mean consolation. It means shift in perspective. First time in the Torah it says the word nechama is ki nichamti ki asisim, right? It's God reconsidering. Pen yinochem ha'am v'shavu mitzrayma, to be more topical, right? It's a reconsideration. So, I'll just talk about the pasuk in Yecheskel that we read at the beginning of the process of getting ready for Pesach, Parshas Parah, a few weeks ago. So in that beautiful pasuk, it says, V'nasati lachem leiv chadash v'ruach chadasha etein bekerbachem v'hasirosi eslev ha'evan mibsarchem v'nasati lachem leiv basar. It's the shift over time from the heart of numbness, the heart of maybe feeling the demimus and feeling that literally weighed down by the stone of shock and numbness. And then over time, it gradually changes, Yecheskel promises us, into leiv basar, a connected heart, a heart that can take in and reconsider and figuring out, as we just heard the friends continue to try to do, in terms of part of that nechama process. And I think, when I think about the key ingredient there, the key ingredient, I think, in part, is the courage for optimism, the courage for hope, and the courage to have gratitude for what you have instead of what you don't have. And I'll just share with you one vignette, and then I'll end with the concluding story. Vignette was something, I don't know, for some reason it didn't make as much of an impact on me when I first experienced it, but then I've been thinking about it more, and I just find it to be so powerful. Hurricane Sandy, right? So there were some neighborhoods that were incredibly impacted by it, especially Bell Harbor, Long Beach, Oceanside, the Five Towns, certain parts of Woodmere, etc. So I was doing a fair amount of speaking, both to therapists there and to the people who were directly impacted. And in the White Shul, my father's shul that he was the rabbi in, you know, until he's now emeritus. He says a lot of people pronounce it emeritus, like a disease. But I was speaking in the White Shul. Far Rockaway, certain sections of Far Rockaway got incredibly, incredibly impacted. And after the talk there, a woman gets up and she says the following. She says, you know, this is about a month after the hurricane. She says, you know, I lost my house. My house is totaled. It's gone. Three cars, gone. You know, the salt water totally destroyed the electrical systems of all those cars. She says, so I basically lost everything I own. She says, but you know something? I've been walking around just totally lifted with a sense of unbelievable happiness for the last month. Everybody's looking at her like either they want to kill her because they're certainly not feeling happy, and just puzzled because it sounds like such a Pollyanna-like statement. But then it made sense because she explained. She said, why am I saying this? She said, because you know what? My parents are survivors. They experienced exactly what I experienced 7 decades ago. They lost their house. They lost everything they owned, but they also lost siblings and parents and grandparents. They didn't lose just things. They lost family. She said, my family is all healthy, thank God. Nobody was lost. Nobody I know was lost in the hurricane. She said, why wouldn't I be happy when I think about my fate compared to my parents' fate? So it's a little bit of a choice about going from Gorol to Yod. And now I'll end with my final story. It'll get us done exactly on time. Last number of years, I've been invited to Frankfurt, Germany, by law, evidently. Companies that benefited from slave labor practices have to put a certain amount of money into a fund that has a program to support Holocaust survivors who still live in Europe. There are about 6,000 or so still alive. and the therapists, mostly Jewish Russians, who were treating them. It's an amazing, amazing experience. But I'm just going to share with you, I'll control myself, just one experience last time I went. And with this, I'll end. The last time I went to the conference, there was a man who I knew had suffered terribly. He had been an adolescent during those horrible years in a camp. And he, for whatever reason, had an incredible sense of joy around him. Everybody wanted to be around him because he sort of put off happiness vibes, a joie de vivre that was beyond belief. He was one of the happiest men I ever saw. And yet I had heard in groups I ran there what he had gone through. And I figure if I don't ask him now, I'm never gonna get this. So I go over to him on the last day, just as we're all getting ready to leave. And I say, you know, what's the secret? You told us what you went through. And I know ma'at min ha'or docha harbe min ha'choshech, little sparks of light push away a great deal of darkness. What's your source of light? You're so happy. Don't have this. This isn't an ounce of bitterness or anything, which you of all people are entitled to. And he looked a little embarrassed. He said, look, he said, and he went through again. He's very articulate. And he described what it was like in the mornings, being woken up at 3, 4 in the morning, being driven by the Nazis into the freezing cold. If you're too slow, the dogs are put on you. If you fall down, you're shot. It was just, he made you feel like you were there. Who could imagine? But he described it. And he said, you know what got me through that? You know what got me through those horrible years? He said, I developed the ability to picture and imagine and feel the warmth of my father's hands on my head as he benched me every Friday night. And the sweetness of his, and the warmth of his breath as he bent down to kiss me after the Friday night bracha. You want to know what got me through? Friday night bracha. That's what got me through. And that's the message that I want to leave as we talk about going from demimus to a place of articulate sense of freedom, going to the naming the monster and talking about everybody's own version of nechama, of reconsideration. And especially as I hope the family comes to a place of gradually reconsidering. Not reconsidering in any other way than to find the meaning of internalizing the meaning of David's life. I'll tell you what everybody told me. What everybody told me over and over again is they were in awe of David's ability to balance a deep devotion to learning, a serious devotion to being really serious about his Judaism, but to never make anybody feel that somehow they were less than because of that, that he was judging them because maybe they weren't as serious. He said he somehow, like this last story I told, made people feel loved and accepted. What a gift. What a gift. And it's still going on. Still going on. Because that's what the boys are telling me 5 years later. So, again, as you go also from the Lev Ha'Evan to the Lev Basar, may we all be Socha as we go around the table on Magid to find the right kinds of steps and meaning in terms of finding ultimate cheiros. Thank you, everybody.